because we wanted to devote it to the Bible session. So just to say a few words about that.
I mean, I sometimes do that. Those are the two together.
Okay, welcome everybody to this session. I think that it is appropriate to devote this session to the memory of Olo Degeler because it was the session where he was supposed to speak. Let me just add a few more words to what was already said, my personal account, so to say. For me, it's a very precious memory because I met him in this wonderful time at the end of the 80s and beginning of the 90s. Where, you know, these are times which come, if you are lucky, once, twice in your lifetime, because the world is completely different than it was before. Before that, it was just islands which knew very little about. And suddenly I came to a conference in Russia, and out of nowhere come a guy with a high mathematical culture, and we found suddenly we speak the same language. It was a very very pleasant encounter. And since then, I had the pleasure and the honor to work with him. We wrote several papers. And he was not only, a great mathematician, but also one of rare persons who somehow was liked by everybody. There was nobody to complain about him. So we will miss him. So let's, this afternoon session will be in his honor. So now I can introduce the first speaker, who is Gregory Bertolaiko from Texas A&M. And the title is Lower Bound for Godel Count on Discrete and Metric Graphs.
So the title is Lower Bound for Godel Count on Discrete and Metric Graph, but, well, because it's a conference, I don't know, I feel mostly about metric graphs. So the proofs will only be for metric graphs. Well, first of all, what are nodal counts? Let's start from far away. Let's consider a very simple equation on an interval of real line minus second derivative psi is equal to k squared psi. We can actually have lambda here. Subject to boundary conditions, psi at 0 is equal to psi at 1 is equal to 0. So it's interval 0 to 1. Now, this one we can readily find all the eigenfunctions and eigenvalues. And the eigenfunctions just sines, right? So it's sine m pi x. So the first one looks like this, and the second one looks like that, etc. And it can be, well, it's pretty obvious for the sine. It can be shown in much more general situations that each next eigenfunction has one more zero than the previous eigenfunction. If we throw away the zeros of an eigenfunction from the interval, like 2 here and 3 here, we see that after we've thrown away the zeros, this is still an interval, but this falls apart into two intervals. And these intervals we'll call nodal domains. A nodal count is nothing else but counting the number of nodal domain for nth eigenfunction. So in this case, we have a very simple statement that nth eigenfunction has exactly n nodal domains. Provided we call this one first and this one second, not zeroth at first. Okay, now let's talk about R2. On R2, before we talk about R2, this result goes back to Sturm in 19th century. Now we can also consider very similar problem on R2. So now we're working on R2. We have an open region in R2, and we define similar sort of equation with similar sort of boundary conditions. So the equation will be minus the Laplacian second derivative with respect to x plus second derivative with respect to y. And the boundary conditions, same as there, Dirichlet boundary, so psi on the boundary of omega is equal to zero. Now, I have some pictures. So let's show the pictures. So this picture was, many of you probably know, this picture was produced by Sven Knutzmann, and with his permission, I stole it from Uzi Smilansky's website. Basically, it's a region in R2. The green bit down below, this is not in the region. So the region is a quarter of a circle and then straight lines. This is pretty high in the spectrum. The blue, this is a picture of an eigenfunction. Now, where eigenfunction is positive, it's red, and when where eigenfunction is negative, it's blue. And the nodal domains are defined in a similar fashion. We just throw away the set where the eigenfunction is zero and see into how many connected components our region falls apart. So this is a nodal domain, but also this red thing is a nodal domain, very long, kind of almost like percolation, and these ideas led people to come up with some interesting statistical results about nodal domains. But anyway, we're just interested in the number of those. And what was shown by Courant in the 1920s is that the nodal count is at most n. So nth eigenfunction has at most n domains. By the way, let me introduce a notation that I'll use throughout. Nu n will be the number of nodal domains of the nth eigenfunction. Okay, so the upper bound is as before, but what about the lower bound? A very simple example, which I copied from a book by Courant and Hilbert, shows that you can't really hope for lower bound. So what you see here is two eigenstates of a square membrane, and on they have the same eigenvalue. There is a degeneracy. So this eigenstate is degenerate, and when you perturb this eigenstate within the same eigenspace, you get the thing on the right. And I filled in so you can see easier. On the left-hand side, we have 12 nodal domains. On the right-hand side, we have just a long sausage of a nodal domain. So we have only two nodal domains. And this, these are two eigenfunctions with the same eigenvalue. And obviously, this number of nodal domains, 2, falls very much below, as low as you can get. So no non-trivial lower bound is possible. This is when the eigenfunctions are degenerate. So maybe degeneracy has something to do with it. But let's have a look here. Well, here, this is another stolen slide. This one I stole from Arndt Becker, with his permission. Of course. These are nodal domain. These are graphs of the eigenfunction of Stadion Billiard. It's not quite nodal domains. It's dark when the function is very high. But you can see there are plenty of what looks like nodal domains in things like this. But here we have this so-called bouncing ball eigenstates, and the domains are much, much fewer than normally. So for these eigenstates, the domain count falls very much below n, the number of the eigenfunction. Okay, that's it with multimedia part of my talk. From now on, it will be only blackboard. So really, no interesting, no non-trivial lower bound is possible. In fact, in a very, very clever development later, Pleyel showed that even the upper bound is achieved very rarely. So this is my sort of easy interpretation of this bound. Nu n is less or equal than 0.7 n for large enough n's. His real result is concerns the upper limit of nu n divided by n, and there is also exact a more exact bound here, but this will serve just as well. So not only the nodal domain count can fall arbitrarily low, it usually stays quite a long way below n, the maximal possible value. Okay, what about graphs? We came here to hear about graphs. And on graphs, I'll only consider the very standard model. So people before me introduced it already. We consider this eigenvalue problem on the bonzo, on the edges of the graph, and the boundary conditions, the matching conditions, this is Kirov conditions or standard conditions. The psi is continuous on vertices, and the sum of outgoing derivatives at each vertex, so psi prime e at 0 is equal to 0. The current conservation condition. For this problem, Knutzmann, Smilansky, and Weber generalized current bound. So Knutzmann, who is in the audience, Smilansky, who is spiritually with us, and Weber. Showed that, again, we have the same upper bound. So it looks pretty similar, but not quite. There are major differences. And it's those differences that I'd like to discuss. Well, the first difference this is really relatively minor difference. Now, let me stop for a moment and go back to the graphs. The graphs were proposed as a model for quantum chaos for Smilansky by Smilansky and Kottas, and as such, they sort of model what happens on the billiards. So intuitively, we would expect things on graphs correspond to what happens on the billiards. That's why I'm talking about differences between this situation and situation on the billiards, on the domain. Okay, so difference number one. This bound only holds for generic eigenstates. Now, why is that and what does it mean? It's easier to give counterexample, and then from the counterexample we'll define what is generic eigenstate. So let's consider a very simple type of graph, star graph. With four edges, doesn't really matter how many. More than two would be nice. For edges, all of the edges have the same length. And I'll take as before this equation, this conditions on the central vertex, and just for simplicity, I'll take that psi on the sort of outer vertices is zero. So directly on the boundary vertices. It is not really important. It just helps to visualize what happens here. Let's picture the first eigenstate. The first eigenstate, here is our star graph. First eigenstate looks like this. Just functions meet above this vertex. The function is everywhere positive, so there is just one nodal domain. And the definition of nodal domains, is again as before. We look at the zeros, we throw them away, we see into how many parts the graph falls apart. Now the next eigenfunction we can construct like this. It is zero on the central vertex and, say, positive on this, two, negative on this. So it doesn't really matter. No, it does matter. It matters that it's positive on two and negative on the other two. And this one has nodal domains, four nodal domains. And this is sort of second eigenfunction. Well, it's not quite second. The problem here is that the second eigenvalue is degenerate. It has degeneracy 3. But technically, one can say that this is the second eigenfunction, and the value is the number of nodal domains is 4. So this bound can be shown for the eigenfunctions which do not take value 0 on any of the vertices. Psi not 0 on vertices. And psi should correspond to simple eigenstate, eigenvalue.
the multiplicities, would then the bound be correct?
Then it's like this. So plus, I believe. Sorry. Steve?
Doesn't Courant have the same problem? If you have a square, isn't the... doesn't satisfy what I'm visualizing. Doesn't satisfy.
What happens if you destroy the symmetry? This thing has a high symmetry.
Well, if you destroy the if the eigenvalue becomes simple, then you don't have a problem.
Differently, if you destroy the symmetry by giving different lengths, do you get degenerate eigenvalues at all?
Generically, no. But again, it can happen even with rationally dependent bond lengths. You can still get degenerate eigenstates. But yeah, this should work. So less or equal than n plus m, which is the multiplicity minus one. That I'm sure works. It works on discrete graphs. So from now on, we'll only talk about generic eigenstates. And you can get them to be generic by perturbing the length a little bit, by destroying the symmetry. Exactly. Now, the second difference, my opinion is more remarkable. I lost my notes. And this is what I want to really talk about. So difference number two is on a tree graph. The nodal count is exact. So nth eigenfunction has exactly generic. Nth eigenfunction has exactly n domains. This result goes back to work. Well, at least I could trace it back to work of Alla Bates. Coordinate Prediv. Years 92, 96, and 04. The paper published in 04. The first one is technical report. And I haven't actually seen the paper. Second one is a short note in Russian, but translated in English. The last one is a big paper translated into English as well, so it's available. And also, work from which I know this result is Shapochnikov. In Russian, you need a lot fewer letters to write this surname. It's 06. Yeah, Germans just put a lot of letters. Of course, if you have enough letters, you can write anything in one letter. Chinese are sort of halfway there. Traffic signs even further along. Now, can we do better? This is just trees. The result I want to talk about is the following theorem. I'll formulate it in a general way. Some contributions are mine. Some, as you can see, are not mine. So on a graph, generic eigenfunction satisfies the following bound. Mu n is less or equal than n, but greater or equal than n minus l. And what is this l? This l is the number of loops in the graph. Loops, by loops I mean cycle. Loops in the graph This is kind of vague. It's also called the dimension of the cycle space. Is better. Also, it's the same as rank of the fundamental group. And putting very simply, it's the number of edges that you need to cut in order to convert the graph into a tree. So if you have a graph like this, you can cut this one, for example, and then you cut, say, this one, and it becomes a tree. So here, L is equal to 2. You can do these cuts in many different ways, but the minimal number is, of course, well-defined. Now, my contribution to this project, as you can probably guess, is this part for L greater than 0. But I'll go through the proof just to give you ideas of the proof of the whole thing. Now, before we go to the proof, let me actually change the setting a little bit so to be more in tune with this thing. So as before, we consider... Actually, I can edit it here. So on the internal vertices, I'll still consider these conditions, but on boundary vertices, on the sort of dangling vertices, I'll consider more general boundary conditions. So psi prime at v times cos alpha v is equal to psi at v times sine alpha v. Sort of Raban type conditions on the free vertices, where alpha is some parameter which can depend on the vertex. It's essentially arbitrary. So the theorem is true for this more general setup, and I'll actually show how to prove it for this more general setup. Now, I already advertised that the same theorem is true for discrete graphs. Let me introduce them quickly and explain what are nodal domains on discrete graphs. Discrete graphs, again graphs, but now functions live not on edges. The edges are just considered to be some combinatorial links, but they take values on the vertices. So functions are really vectors in RV, where V is the number of vertices. And the Laplacian, the eigenvalue equation is... the Laplacian denoted by H, or, well, in this case, it's Schrödinger equation, the Schrödinger operator, minus psi v. So we look at all the vertices which are adjacent to a given vertex u. We add together the values of the function there with minus, and then we add the value of the function at u with some potential q. So we consider, again, this eigenvalue problem. In this case, of course, the spectrum is finite, but still the same can be said about the nodal domains on these things if we define the nodal domains. Now, the way we define nodal domains is kind of similar. Again, let's not talk about the case when function is zero on any of the vertices. Let's say it's positive here, positive here, positive here, negative, negative, positive. And what we do, we cut the links that connect positive to negative vertices. This one, this one, this one, this one. And then again, look into how many pieces we have split the graph. This will be the number of domains. So in this case, nu is equal to 3. With the same conditions, this theorem will be true for discrete graphs. Now, just to show that generic, this condition that the things are generic is important, I'll construct a very simple example where you can see that it's important. Again, all counterexamples are best done on star graphs. So let's consider a star graph, which is almost generic, in the sense that has a lot of legs, and the lengths of the edges are assumed to be greater than 1, and can be anything, irrational. Actually, let's assume that they're greater than 1, but not too far away. So it's 1 plus epsilon, depending on E. They can be irrational. One of them should be equal to 1, and another one should be equal to 1 over m. So there is a very short one here. And the construction of a bad eigenstate is again based on the fact that on the graph you can get an eigenfunction which is localized exactly on some edges and is identically zero everywhere else. We can get an eigenstate which is localized to these two. That's the idea. This eigenstate should have eigenvalue m pi, I guess. So it's kind of sine here. Let's blow it up. So it's sine here, 0 takes value here, and then sine like this. Negative, positive. So and on the rest of the graph, it's identically 0. Now, this eigenstate has one domain here, and m domains on the other thing. So nu would be equal to m plus 1. However, if we pack enough of the other edges into this graph, then we can, just simply counting the eigenvalues, we can find out that this eigenvalue is very high in the spectrum, m times n minus 1 plus 1. Where n is the number of whole edges on the graph. So, as you can see, the nodal count can fall arbitrarily below the number of the eigenstate if we allow non-generic situations. So genericity is essential. All right, and now I have 15 minutes to give you an idea of the proof. But the idea is really simple. Essentially, once you've guessed this thing, you can see what to do. You know that you need to cut the graph into a tree, which brings me to where is the duster? To the history of this little discovery. I owe it to two people. One is Uzi Smolyansky, who asked me to give a talk about work by Shapochnikov. At this point, I didn't know about other people's work. On work by Shapochnikov at his conference, and then I started looking at the proof. Another person was Rami Bant, who is present in the audience, who showed me his work on as a spectral graph and on one of the graphs, which looked like this. He showed me the nodal count, and the nodal count nu n was alternating between n and n minus 1. And I thought, what's the meaning of 1? That maybe the loop, and from there it all became clear. So the idea is, we'll take the graph and we'll cut some links. We'll cut some links, and then by cutting the links, we'll split some and we'll possibly split some nodal domains into two, well, one of them. But we'll also do something to the spectrum. And what do we do to the spectrum? Well, imagine a glass. And imagine if it's cracked, then the sound will be lower, right? That is saying that if we remove a constraint, if it's a crack, it's as if a constraint, it was glued together before, but now it's moving independently. So a constraint removed means the spectrum goes lower. Constraint imposed means the spectrum is higher. So use this idea and get some estimates on the eigenvalue and nodal domains. Now I'll do really simple things. So first of all, let's define the quadratic form on this graph. So h is the Laplace operator, the second derivative. And the quadratic form, once you evaluate it, will be integral over the whole graph. This will denote graph psi prime x squared dx plus some boundary terms due to this condition. Psi squared tan alpha v. Psi squared at v. Sum of all boundary vertices v. So we'll need this thing. We will need a formulation for the eigenvalues in terms of quadratic form. This is so-called minimax principle. It's maximum of minimum. So we take this quadratic form and we try to minimize it over size in the domain. By the way, the domain of this quadratic form is Sobolev space on the graph. So we minimize the quadratic form over psi in the domain normalized to 1. But then we impose some constraints, phi 1 up to phi k, and we require that psi be orthogonal to phi j, all of this. Almost direct consequence of this thing is Rayleigh's theorem of constraint. Which is essentially the theorem about the glass. So if we have H, a self-adjoint operator on D, and H phi will be a restriction of H to a smaller domain, where the smaller domain is defined as all functions that are orthogonal to phi, then the spectrum of this new operator, so we're imposing a constraint, so the spectrum goes up. lambda n are the eigenfunctions of this one, mu n are the eigenvalues of h, and the theorem says that mu n is between lambda n and lambda n plus 1. Is this right? Constraint, I think I got it opposite. Ah, yes. So this is lambda is spectrum of H, mu is spectrum of H far. And this works. And another simple fact that we'll need. Is also related to the formulations of the eigenvalues by the quadratic form. And it says that if we found psi for which this minimum is achieved, then this psi is the eigenfunction, and only eigenfunctions will minimize this. So if we define dn to be psi such that psi is orthogonal to the first n minus 1 eigenfunctions, then we'll have that q phi is greater or equal than the nth eigenvalue. So if a function is orthogonal to first n minus 1 eigenvalue, then the minimum value of the quadratic form on it is the nth eigenvalue. And the equality here happens if and only if phi is the next eigenstate, plus minus. Okay, now we are in position to quickly prove the whole thing. So first, the generalization of the current bound, current side of the bound. So now we are proving that nu n is less or equal than n. Well, let's fix n, and let's assume the contrary. Assume the contrary, we have at least n plus 1 domains. We have n plus 1 domains, and then we'll define the functions um, which coincides with the eigenfunction on mth domain and zero otherwise. So we have our set of domains. We just take the eigenfunction and cut out the pieces of eigenfunction living on one domain. And we call these pieces um. And we have at least n plus 1 of them, maybe more. And then make a new function u, which is a combination of ums, but now m goes from 1 to n. We do not use all of them. By playing with coefficients, we can get this u to live in the n, to be orthogonal to the first n minus 1 eigenstates. Okay. Once we have this, we can calculate q on this function u. And because of what q was, just this, it's second derivative inside these domains. So nothing really changed from psi n. This will be equal to lambda n. So we have constructed another eigenfunction, which is, this thing is 0, but u is 0 on n plus first domain. So we have constructed a function which takes right minimal value but is different from the eigenfunction. Therefore, we have a contradiction. And on R2, of course, you don't even need to require that the eigenstate is simple, because once you have constructed an eigenfunction which is zero on an open set, you know that it cannot happen. But on graphs, it can happen, so we need to require that there are no other eigenstates apart from psi n. Okay, so that proves the first part. Somebody's taking my erasers. Oh. Now, the next part is the lower bound for L equal to 0. So part 2, L equal to 0. We have a tree, and we want to understand what happens to the tree. So what we do to the tree, we choose one vertex, call it a root, and then order the tree in this fashion. And then say, OK, we have conditions on all these vertices, including this one. And then we remove the condition of this vertex and extend it to infinity. And then we try to solve the eigenvalue equation starting from these leaves going up. So in essence, we get psi x lambda. This is solution of the eigenvalue equation, which doesn't satisfy the condition at the vertex that we removed. So this is, no, better call it phi, solution to the equation minus the equation as before, plus conditions everywhere, but the root. Now, for simplicity, let's assume that originally we had Dirichlet condition here at the root. And now let's see what happens. As we change lambda, one can show that as we change lambda, the zeros of this function will go down, only down. When a zero comes down to a vertex, it decides where it wants to go. It doesn't split. It goes only to one of the branches. Only one. The zeros do not split. The zeros do not merge. Otherwise, we would have both function and its derivative zero at the same point. So that's we exclude this when we talk about generic things. So the zeros go down. And when a zero, which was originally there, it goes down, and it passes through a point where the root used to be, then we know we have an eigenfunction. As we increase lambda, we know the zero entered the tree and is somewhere there, and then we just do counting of the zeros. We find that there are n minus 1 of them in the tree, so the tree is split into n parts by the zeros. That's the outline of the argument. And the third part, L greater than 0, well, let's just take L equal to 1. We have a graph which has just one cycle. Apart from that, it's a tree. Choose a point, call it XC, and cut the graph along this point, at this point. So this was G, the graph, and now we have a tree. And the tree inherits all the boundary conditions from the graph, but now we have two new points here, and we need to decide on the boundary conditions at this point. And let me get a bit more formal. So what we do is, okay, so we fix n and fix nth eigenfunction, call it f. and nth eigenvalue, call it rho. Just calling things different names cannot hurt. And then at this point, we define A plus to be derivative of f x cut plus divided by f x cut, and A minus is derivative on the other side going in the other direction divided by the same value. So we get it from here, and then we apply this A to here. So on this tree, we now impose our boundary conditions to be psi at x cut plus minus. Now the x cut is 2 points, no? Is equal to, sorry, derivative, is equal to a plus minus x cut plus minus. All sounds very, maybe a bit complicated, but basically the idea is we want to impose exactly such boundary conditions here so that the function f that was eigenfunction there is still eigenfunction on the tree, nothing else. This was pretty useful. This was definition of the quadratic form on the graph. Now let's write two quadratic forms, on the graph and on the tree. Quadratic form on the tree, well, it will be exactly the same as on the graph, apart from two new terms which appear because of this boundary point. So it will be equal to h on the graph plus couple of more terms, a plus psi squared x cut plus a minus psi squared x cut minus. Domains. Domain on the graph is the same as the domain on the tree. With the difference that on the graph we actually require continuity at the point where we cut it. So we require that phi at x cut plus is equal to phi at x cut minus. We also have very from here by from the way we defined a plus and a minus, that a plus is equal to minus a minus. So then we put two and two together, and we see that on the smaller domain on D, on the graph, the quadratic form, why is it H? It's quadratic form, it's Q.
No, it's line above. It's
line above. Yeah, but it's Q. It was denoted by Q. So QT is equal to QG. Just because that these values are now the same, but A's are the same, have different sign. They cancel each other. So basically, it's exactly the same operator, but the operator on the graph as a constraint. So that's a good point. It's important to get it right. So QG is restriction of QT. Now QG, this had spectrum lambda. This had spectrum, call it mu. And we know that our function f was eigenfunction both here and here, and correspondingly rho was both here and there. The difference is that it could take different, it was at a different place in it is at a different place in these two spectra. So rho we know for sure was lambda n, but in this spectrum it could be at a different place, mu r. But from Rayleigh's theorem we know that lambda k is greater or equal than mu k. And if this is true, then we would have that r must be greater or equal than n. Now let's look at the number of nodal domains of F with respect to the tree. Now with respect to the tree, we might have cut one nodal domain in two and might not. So it's either nu, the same nu on graphs, or the same nu on graphs on the graph plus one. One of these. But what we know for sure is that it's less or equal than nu on graph plus one. We also know that this thing is equal to R because it's a tree. We've proven the theorem on the trees, so we know that nu on the tree is equal to the index of the eigenvalue with respect to the tree. And now we just put it all together. We put it all together and we have the following string. N, which is less or equal than R, according to this inequality, is equal to nu g, which is less nu tree, which is less or equal than nu graph plus 1. Move this one to the other side. We get that nu of f on the graph is greater or equal than n minus 1. And that's the end of the proof. Okay. And, that's the end of the proof of the theorem, and a couple of remarks for the questions that I don't know answers to are, first of all, we know that nu n is between n and n minus l. What is not known is precisely which values in this range it takes and in which cases. So what values? The second thing is, can this information be used somehow when we approximate billiards by graphs and then answer questions on billiards? For example, as far as I understand, the following statement is unknown on graphs, that the lim sup of nu n on billiards is infinity. Maybe we can somehow approximate billiards by graphs and get things there as well. Okay, that's it.
You saved your coffee.
Yes.
Okay, questions, comments? Yeah.
Your result with this L.
Uh-huh.
Maybe it suggests that there is something related to this one forms, because you can look at eigenvalues for one forms, and because you have harmonic forms whose dimension is exactly this L, you mm-hmm. have a shift, you have something like a shift in the labeling of. But nodal domain for one form is something, there are two possibilities. Either you look at points where the one form vanish,
mm-hmm.
which corresponds to the point where the derivative of the function vanishes.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
But maybe it should be interesting to put that in the context of one form and to see if it's mm-hmm. related, mm-hmm. because it's completely topological issue.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know. But
okay, yeah. Also a comment rather than a question. So
no, of course.
Yeah, well, comments are welcome. Yeah. Here,
I have a mixture of question and comment, and it's kind of related, but I have a little bit different impression. It seems to me that so you show that tree is actually Courant bound is always okay, but trees beat the play L. But trees don't look like Euclidean spaces. They look like hyperbolic, domain. So I wonder what is known about whether there is anything like Pleyel in hyperbolic Laplacian. Maybe there is not. And so if this is correct, then when you try to approximate Billiard with those things, L will have to increase. You cannot approximate Euclidean domains by trees. You will have to put more loops, and probably this lower bound might deteriorate. So it might about...
It would be very lucky.
About curvature, I don't know. So but for hyperbolic, I don't know what is known besides the standard Courant. So.
Okay. Well, do you know anything about what happens when n gets bigger? I mean, a certain range here. Do you know if the number of domains can bounce around, or is it stabilized?
Ask the person who is sitting next to you. Basically, in the graphs that they considered, the number just was bouncing between n minus 1 and n, and 50% of the time it was n minus 1, 50% of the time it was n.
But I make a general question. For the general Turkin value, is there an invariant way of describing the number of nodal domains? So if I have a degenerate, say M, I want to have M numbers, but defined in some rigorous way, independently of how I choose the elements of subspace.
It's a good question. I don't know of any such way. Okay, when you have integrable systems, then you have some sort of standard separable system.
No,
this case, it's kind of, there is something natural, but in more general things, I don't know. It's a good question.
Okay, more questions? If there are none, let's thank the speaker again. We need that resource after coffee.